Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Local governments in nearly two dozen states, including here in Kentucky, are being swamped with an unprecedented wave of public records requests. For many, especially eastern Kentucky counties still struggling to recover from the July flooding, this avalanche of sometimes identically worded requests is forcing these officials to dedicate a lot of time to the tedious process of responding to each request. And it's happening not only during a stressful time for many local government officials in the region, it's happening as they're trying to get ready for the November 8th elections. What is going on? We're joined by Michael Adams, the Kentucky Secretary of State, whose job description includes, well, let's let him tell us about that. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Secretary Adams.
Thanks so much, Tom. Glad to be here.
And people might confuse the office that you hold with the one in Washington that has to do with foreign policy and diplomacy. What do state-level Secretary of States do?
Well, it actually varies by state constitution and state law. We're all a little different from each other. But in Kentucky, I'm literally the Secretary of the State. I'm the Chief Custodian of Records for 4.5 million Kentuckians. I've got land records, legislative records, acts of the governor, and so forth in my office in the Capitol. Number two, I'm the Chief Business Official. Every business in Kentucky registers with and reports to us annually. And third, last but not least, I'm the Chief Election Official for Kentucky.
Okay. In that capacity, tell us what you're hearing about these public records requests from local government offices around the state.
Well, the theme of remarks as I've been traveling the state recently is it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. Elections have never been better in Kentucky than they have been the past few years. We've worked really hard in a bipartisan fashion to build consensus on improving our election laws and processes, making voting easier, also improving the security of our process. And there's a lot of good news there. We've obtained a lot of funding to upgrade our equipment and so forth, improve our security. It's also the worst of times, though, because unfortunately, we have some folks who are blind to reality, willfully so, and despite the improvements, they actually are doubling down with irresponsible suspicions. And people can certainly believe as they choose, but when they act on those beliefs in a way that disrupts our process, it becomes a real concern. And so with respect to our local election officials, these are people who are known in their communities. They're trusted. Many times the local voters know them personally. They go to church with them or they see them at their grocery. Their kids know each other. These people should not be subjected to irrational suspicion as being corrupt and trying to steal elections for anybody. And unfortunately, they've been targeted in a way that used to just be something that I dealt with. They're being sued. They're having demands placed on them, demands to produce records and open their offices for inspection and so forth. And our system's just not designed for that.
Have some county clerks been quitting?
Yeah, I'll put this into perspective. 2020 was about the hardest year in any election official's lifetime. We worked just brutal hours trying to make sure we could safely vote in the pandemic and that we acclimated to the different reality at that time. We lost two of our county clerks that year. They quit. They couldn't handle the stress. And as bad as 2020 was, I really thought 2022 would be a cakewalk. We've actually had six county clerks resign this summer. Three times as many as resigned in 2020, which is really telling about the morale, unfortunately, of our local officials and the level of stress of this job.
Well, in mid-August, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell, he's a prominent ally of former President Donald Trump, who has spent the past couple of years spreading false claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, called on his followers to request copies of what's known as cast vote records from every election office in the country. And now every county in Kentucky is receiving these requests. Is there evidence that a coordinated campaign is driving this flood of public record requests?
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of points of evidence. One is we have video footage of a Kentucky legislator participating in a panel discussion with Mr. Lindell, encouraging people to bombard our Kentucky election officials with these frivolous demands. And to be sure, we have an open records law in Kentucky, and we comply with that law. It's public record, and it's open to the public. If people want to see our work, it's transparent. We have nothing to hide. But to wait until we're in the midst of preparing for a very significant election, top to bottom, a large number of races on the ballot, to wait until we're in that process to then demand voluminous records from an election 2 years ago, it looks like it's being done on purpose. So that's one point of evidence. The other is that a lot of these requests, they read word for word the same, and in the first instance, they were sent from out-of-state addresses. Well, by law, we don't have to comply with those. But then what we saw was we saw Kentuckians then copying and pasting those directives and sending them to us. And the language is really kind of garbled and doesn't make any sense. And when our county clerks call these folks and say, hey, what are you looking for? They don't know. They've just been told to send these requests for all these various types of documents, and sometimes they don't exist. And again, it's just a copy and paste job that's being directed at us from elsewhere.
Well, to give our listeners an idea of the consequences of this, under Kentucky law, these public agencies are required to respond to these open records requests within 5 days. Could you describe for us what happens in a county clerk's office when they're flooded with these requests?
Yeah, and I'll actually tell you about my office, too. Look, it's really hard right now for anyone to have adequate staff and do their job. It's hard for us to keep people. It's hard for county clerks to keep people. These are government jobs. The pay is not very high, and the stress is very high. And so you've got county clerks that are trying to run their tax payments division and the elections part of their office and all the other things that they do, and then suddenly you have people demanding that they produce voluminous records from a warehouse from 2 years ago. And the law requires you to acknowledge the request. Sometimes you don't have to honor all of it, but you still have to deal with it. And when you suddenly get hundreds of them, it gums up your wheels. And it makes it harder, that much harder, to do your real job, which is to prepare for another election that's upcoming. And what I'm concerned about is, are our county clerks going to be pushed off target by these absurd demands? And then do we have problems in the election because of that? And then will that just further enable the people that are falsely saying that we have broken elections in Kentucky?
Well, Matt Crane, he heads the Colorado County Clerks Association. He's calling this records request campaign a denial of service attack on local government. And that's a term for an intentional bombardment of a computer network for the purpose of shutting it down. Would you agree with that assessment?
I can't speak to the motive of the people that send these. I just don't have personal knowledge of it. But I do think that the terminology used at the national level, I think there is some intent to gum up our works. The word bombard was literally used against me by Mr. Lindell. He called on his supporters to, quote, bombard me. So I don't think this is about trying to have a good faith request. Matt, they could send one request and we could meet it. When someone tries to get thousands of people to, quote, bombard somebody, I think you can probably gauge the intent from that.
Did that follow your quote in the Washington Post where you said that Mike Lindell's claim that this effort is about ensuring public confidence in election integrity is a lie?
Well, according to Mr. Lindell, yes. He was called for comment after I offered an interview to the Washington Post and before the story ran. But that's right. He was, I guess, responding to me, trying to defend my state.
Well, this unusually high volume of identical requests coming with an election that's just now weeks away, in your opinion, is this about obtaining information or is it really about making it more difficult to run a smooth election?
Well, I certainly think that with respect to out-of-state actors, this is about disrupting our election. I can't speak to individual Kentuckians and what their state of mind is. I don't know. And again, to be sure, I do think it's legitimate for people to have questions about the election, to be able to file requests and get information. That's our job to provide that. I just don't want to see that abused, and I certainly don't want to see our election system suffer for it.
Well, the Republican Party controls not just both of Kentucky's seats in the U.S. Senate, 5 of the state's 6 U.S. House seats, at least 75% of the seats in both chambers of the state legislature, and a majority of county judge executive positions. And the state legislature passed a budget this most recent session that allocated more money to run elections. And there's a new law, I believe, that places surveillance cameras on voting machines, presumably.
Outside of voting hours, that's right.
Okay, and presumably makes them more secure. So why go to all this effort in a state with such a Republican majority?
Well, so I think it's a couple of things. I think, number one, this is being driven by one fringe of one party, which is to say my party, that don't recognize more mainstream Republicans as legitimate. This is part of a wider process of delegitimizing more traditional Republicans and taking over the party and having a different style and a different tone. And that part of it. The other part of it is the same people that we've seen that are spreading false information about the election process also spread false information about vaccines. There is a certain paranoid fringe out there that don't believe anything the government says, and I'm the government. So they necessarily assume that anything I'm doing is wrong and corrupt, and they've got to come storm the gates and throw the bums out and do it themselves. We actually saw in some of the frivolous recount lawsuits that we had to deal with over this summer, demands by the losing candidates, people who lost by 20, 30, even 60 points, they wanted to do the recounts themselves. They said, no, we don't want the government doing it. We want to count the ballots ourselves. Well, obviously, that's a conflict of interest, but it really sort of shows you, I think, the mindset of what's essentially vigilantes that want to overturn the government and do things their own way.
Is all of this happening because a lot of people have been convinced that the 2020 election was stolen, and so they believe it's their patriotic duty to prevent it from happening again, even though scores of judges all over the country, many of them Trump appointees, have found zero evidence of voter fraud? Are there genuine causes for concern about election integrity in Kentucky and America?
Well, I won't speak for the whole country. I'll speak for my state. I think there's zero rational basis to have these sorts of fears about our state. And I don't think that you can judge whether an election is fair by whether your candidate wins or not. But in any event, to your point, Republicans did pretty well in Kentucky in 2020. And so the argument has kind of shifted away from Democrats are cheating to Republican rhino incumbent swamp people like Michael Adams are cheating. And that's a shift of emphasis because they've been so thoroughly debunked as to their predictions about 2020 in Kentucky that they've pivoted now to saying that our primaries are illegitimate, and that's the basis for their lawsuits to overturn the primary election results. And I might add, they didn't sue to overturn election results that they won. Their wing of the party actually did pretty well in some places and beat some incumbents. They were just fine with the tech of the machines in those instances, even though it's the same technology that the whole state uses.
Are you anticipating a flood of vote challenges after the midterm elections on November 8th?
You know, I'm not sure what to expect. Most of the people who are of this mindset, they either have already sued and lost on the recounts for the primary and are not nominated, or they are nominated and they're going to get elected in November and they don't really have anything to challenge. So the only real plaintiff class to bring more of these recount lawsuits, I think, would be hopeless Republican nominees in very Democratic districts. And I don't know that they'll have the resources or be able to raise the resources to pose those challenges. I am going to ask the legislature in January to pass a law to limit the access to a recount proceeding to those who come within 1% of the vote or less. We actually had a frivolous re-canvass 2 years ago by a guy that lost by 20 points. That was a big problem for us to have to deal with. We did the re-canvass, notwithstanding that it wasn't close, and we got the loophole closed to a 1% margin to get a re-canvass. Well, recount's an even bigger proceeding. So I think we need the same sort of limitation on the recounts. We don't want them abused.
And do we have enough poll workers for November 8th?
Well, we don't yet, but we're working really hard on it. Our office is repeating all the programs we had 2 years ago to recruit poll workers. It's actually, as a matter of law, the job of the two political parties at the county level to produce the poll workers. And unfortunately, you see a lot of atrophy with local party organizations on both sides, that they become basically social media creatures attacking incumbents instead of organizers who help produce volunteers to work the polls. We do require by law in Kentucky that we have both Democrats and Republicans at every single precinct working the polls. So we've got bipartisan checks and balances. So unfortunately, they've not kept up their end of the bargain. And so I've worked with the State Bar Association, with state wineries and brewers, and the YMCA to assist us on the ground in finding poll workers. And we're seeing some success from that. We've seen a much more robust opening of voting locations this year compared to 2 years ago. And that's partly because of course, the vaccine and the pandemic beginning to wane. But it's also a function, I think, of these recruiting efforts.
You mentioned the chatter on social media, and I've seen some a little bit scary that raises the possibility of harassment at polling places. Are there plans to provide security at the polls, or are you concerned about that?
I don't think that we're going to have an issue in 99% of our locations. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, by law, the sheriff of every county is on the County Board of Elections, and those individuals are empowered to address these situations, and they have a much better sense of facts on the ground for these situations. We had the same kind of concerns in 2020, and fortunately, they didn't really materialize. So I don't have immediate concerns. I don't have knowledge of any imminent threat to any of our poll workers or election officials. You know, we get social media hits and occasionally threats. They tend to be from out of state. They tend to be not credible threats. We refer them to the FBI, as we've been asked to do, but I don't have currently any reason to believe that there is any physical risk to any of our volunteers at this time.
Well, you know, if you told me 10 years ago that I would even be asking these questions of you, I wouldn't have believed it. But what do you think, what happened to the idea that we can all agree to disagree agreeably?
Well, I've been thinking about that, too. I've read some books over the summer, Bowling Alone, The Big Sort, The Death of Expertise, to try to understand these social phenomena. And this is not just about the elections. Again, this is a larger movement, and it's global. It's not just Kentucky or even just America. You've got decreased faith in institutions, and unfortunately, you've got people that take advantage of that by grifting, and they build these huge YouTube follower accounts and put out their own information off the grid. And again, people who don't believe the government will believe anyone who says something that the government supposedly is up to that's bad. And so that's a big challenge for us, is just the decline in civic literacy and the willingness of people to be gullible and vulnerable to this kind of misinformation.
All right. That's Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Secretary Adams mentioned a need for civic literacy. That's the aim of Civic Shorts, our series in partnership with CivicLex and its director, Richard Young, to define the job descriptions of down-ballot local offices. Our latest, magistrates and county commissioners.
The concept of magistrates and county commissioners in Kentucky dates back to the state constitution, adopted in 1792, which called for appointed justices of the peace to help in governing smaller areas like counties. In 1850, justices of the peace became an elected position. Now, according to state law set by the Kentucky General Assembly, every county in Kentucky is required to have a governing body that consists of an elected county judge executive and either a set of commissioners or magistrates. Together, judge executives and commissioners or magistrates make up the fiscal court for a county, which supervises the affairs of the county, including buying and selling property, maintaining roads and buildings, and more. Counties in Kentucky have options for how to structure their county government, which can be adopted or changed through an election. Each Kentucky county can have an elected judge executive and then can have either three commissioners or 3 to 8 magistrates. Magistrates are elected by districts within the county, while commissioners are generally elected at large or across the entire county. If a county opts for a 3-at-large county commissioner structure, magistrates can still be elected for largely ceremonial purposes. Magistrates and county commissioners are generally active when the county fiscal court is in session, but will have occasional administrative and research work in the interim. Fayette County is unique when it comes to government structures and magistrates or county commissioners. Since Lexington-Fayette County's merged urban county government assumes much of the powers of the fiscal court, its county commissioner and magistrate positions have far less responsibility, but they are still elected to comply with the state constitution. Lexington-Fayette County has 3 magistrates elected by districts and 3 county commissioner seats. County commissioners in Lexington-Fayette County meet 3 times per year with the Fayette County Judge Executive to set ad valorem tax rates. Magistrates in Fayette County are largely ceremonial, but they can officiate marriages. Fayette County elects magistrates and county commissioners every 4 years. This year, in 2022, all magistrates and county commissioners are running unopposed. Magistrate candidates are Rosalind Bryant in District 1, Lisa Moore Faith in District 2, and George Biggerstaff in District 3. County commissioner candidates are Brian Miller, Elaine White, and one seat with no candidate. Make sure to register to vote or check that your registration is up to date by October 11th, 2022 to participate in the upcoming election. You can do that at govoteky.com. Want to learn more about the positions on the ballot in Fayette County? Head on over to lex.vote to learn more. Want more information on all things local government? You can check out our website at civiclex.org. From there, you can subscribe to our CivicLex weekly newsletter and follow us on all social media. From CivicLex for Eastern Standard, I'm Richard Young.
A correction, we mentioned in last week's segment that Fayette County constables serve 2-year terms, when in fact the constable's term is 4 years. Lots more ahead. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops also support veterans in the communities they serve through an honor flight to Washington, D.C. More about how co-ops are making a difference at honorflightky.org. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Teachers leaving for other occupations or quitting altogether, learning loss and stress among students during the pandemic. How do these issues look in the biggest school district in our coverage area, Lexington-Fayette County? Education contributor Bridget Blom takes up the question with Fayette County Schools Superintendent Demetris Liggins.
Superintendent Liggins, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
Research shows repeatedly that within a school, teachers matter most when it comes to student outcomes. So when the public hears we don't have enough teachers, there's genuine and rightful concern. How is Fayette County experiencing the teacher shortage?
Well, I will tell you, Bridget, we're actually doing quite well compared to many of our surrounding areas and fellow districts. We are mostly staffed. We, unfortunately, like many other districts, are having some difficulty with some of our secondary positions, our math and science at the high school level, but that has always been very difficult to staff. But we are fortunate enough to have excellent partnerships with Kentucky colleges and universities that place us in a much better situation than many of the districts around the state and the country.
Washington Post report talked about, you know, states recruiting teachers from other states with retention packages and bonuses for coming. And so I think when folks in Kentucky hear that, they think, oh, no, not only do we have a shortage, but our teachers might go out of state. So to know that's not the experience that you have in Lexington right now is good news.
Yes, it is. In fact, we're a destination district for so many districts throughout the area. So we, in some instances, recruit from around us, which is fortunate for our individual school district, but quite unfortunate for the Commonwealth in general. But Lexington, as you know, have a lot of things that draw people from surrounding areas to come here. We were actually voted from the Forbes list, one of the top employers in the Commonwealth this past year. So that recognition of the incredible children and families that we work with and the fantastic team members here really help us recruit.
So how about other staff positions? You know, I think Davis County reported that they were going to have to delay the start of school because of a lack of bus drivers. How are other staff positions going in Fayette County?
Well, you know, we're doing better this year overall than we were last year. We're in a much better position. We are obviously still having some issues and can always use more bus drivers. We've learned to make work what we have, but that is definitely an area where we struggle. Additionally, we're looking to hire additional custodians and special education paraeducators and substitute teachers. We are still in a pandemic, and many of our substitute teachers that we've previously had were retirees. And we found that many of those individuals, due to their age groups, are just not interested in coming to schools any longer to sub, just due to their own personal health concerns. And so really always recruiting more substitutes as well.
And it's an all-important time for almost as many folks as we can get into our school buildings to support student learning to be there, as
Absolutely.
We're, to your point, still really in the midst of a global health pandemic, but also in hopefully a place of beginning to recover from learning loss.
Yes, we've actually put in a lot of work with our curriculum team to ensure that we can take some of that learning loss into consideration, because our kids obviously have matriculated through their grade levels, but yet still have lots of gaps. So we're making sure that we're doing all we can to help support that in our regular curriculum. But having a fully staffed school is definitely a contributor to the success of students when students have every resource available to them that is actually in the overall plan.
When we think about the teaching profession and that labor force in particular, attracting people into the profession, supporting them as they gain skills to be an effective teacher, and then retaining them over a number of years. All those things are important, and there are strategies for each. Are there promising strategies you've identified for attracting young people into the profession?
That's an issue that we are facing as a nation, and it's just not a Fayette County issue, but we need to do more as a profession of making teaching a desirable position for college graduates to aspire to become. And so one of the things we're doing, again, is partnering with our universities that are both local and throughout the Commonwealth to ensure that teachers have opportunities to have reimbursement of their tuition. We've also started a Grow Your Own program here, to where we have many individuals who are degreed and working in other departments, and we're trying to incentivize them to go into education and receive their alternative teaching certification. So we want to ensure that we continue to be competitive. We want to ensure that people that stigma of if you go into education, you can't afford to take care of a family or have a living wage. We really want to take that away and let every individual know that if you're working in Fayette County Public Schools here in Lexington, Kentucky, you will make a decent wage. You will work in an environment where you're supported, and we want you here. And so really, I think quite often it's a matter of just letting people know, we want you, we need you, and once you're here, we're going to take good care of you in any way that we can.
So once you have teachers on board, what are some of the strategies to support them in their professional growth to be that effective teacher day in and day out?
Well, every teacher that comes in is assigned a mentor, and they're assigned a mentor that is really someone that they can go to for anything that is going to, especially our first-year teachers who have zero experience. Quite often that is a mentor, one mentor that they can just ask any question that they want. And then we have another program where there's an instructional mentor, someone that may teach a similar course that they teach, and that they can go and they can visit their classroom, they can ask questions, they can observe. And we've invested in our professional development immensely, to where individuals can be paid for additional hours of professional development, so they're not feeling as if they're having to take their own time and resources to make that happen. And we're also asking our teachers what they would like to receive more professional development on, as well as asking our principals and campus leaders to say what are some of the problems we're seeing systematically, and providing professional development on that as well. And you may find that some professional development is done by some of these very mentors that I've talked about, and not just necessarily the administrators or the so-called content experts, but they're people that are still in the classroom and still experiencing the challenges that come with being in the classroom in today's time. And so that our teachers realize that this is going to be very relevant and timely for their growth.
It's been an incredibly challenging public political time for teachers. What would you say to the community at large in Fayette County about supporting public education and teachers right now so that we truly can help students recover from the COVID years?
It's always been this way, but we're at a much more critical time now to where we need to wrap our arms around our teachers and really show them that we're supporting the challenges that they're having to endure day in and day out. I think it's important for our teachers and our community to recognize that our teachers are professionals. They go through lots of not only their formal education, but once they are in the classroom, they continue to grow, they continue to learn, and we are doing very prescriptive instructional practices for individual students. And so really recognizing teachers for the professionals that they are, I think is of critical importance. And also we need to make sure that our teachers and understand that our teachers are also human beings that are within the same society that we are, and they too have personal challenges. We've had for the past few years the pandemic where we've paid a lot of attention to the needs of our students as well as we should have. But we also need to realize that our teachers and our educators are experiencing personal losses and personal health issues as well. And so really humanizing the fact that, you know, we're doing all that we can as well, but our teachers are also human, and we have to make sure that we're taking care of that side as well. So any way we can wrap our arms around educators at this time is of the utmost importance. I think any time you can lobby your local legislators or state representatives or even at the national level to make sure that we're investing in education in the way that it should be, it's also beneficial. And there's been, as you know, we've been infused with millions of dollars from stimulus funds to help in the classroom, but there's a cliff coming. And some of the things that we've implemented in our classrooms that are helping increase those student learning opportunities will soon go away. And unfortunately, the impacts of the pandemic are lasting much longer than anyone had anticipated. Last year, I think it was so difficult because for so many people, they said it was their toughest year in education because I think we expected something different when we came in. We're expecting to go back to normal. And then we ended up with all of these different variants, and it was still teachers and students were still in and out. And so many of the things that we had planned and many of the funds we had put into place to impact the loss of learning for previous years carried over into last year. And so this year, again, we're hoping for a quote-unquote whatever normal year is now could be described as. But we are seeing that those funds are running out quite quickly, and we haven't had a chance to really impact student learning the way that it needs to be done. So anything that people can do to just embrace our teachers, embrace our educators, and realize that these are some of the hardest working individuals that you'll ever meet. And we're all here for kids.
The community can be powerful in supporting education.
Absolutely.
Superintendent Liggins, it's been a pleasure to speak with you this afternoon. Thank you for joining us, and best of luck.
Thank you so much, Bridget. It's always a pleasure.
Some big days are coming in the weeks ahead. First, a birthday that's going to require a lot of candles. Joining us are Lisa Meek and Hayward Wilkerson, who won the contract with the city to operate the historic Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington. The Kentucky is coming up on its 100th anniversary, and there are big plans to celebrate that. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lisa and Hayward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So to commemorate this milestone, you planned a month of celebration, and it begins on October the 8th. What's happening on October the 8th?
Well, our actual birthday is on October 4th, and we'll turn 100 years old then. But that's in the middle of the week, not a great day for a party. And also, we want the mayor to be able to be there and celebrate with us. So our big party will be on Saturday, October 8th. And it's kind of a double feature idea. So the first half of the evening will be fancy shishi gala. It'll be $100 a ticket. There'll be a delicious food, lovely drinks. We'll have silent films that are short, like 10, 15 minutes from the era when we opened. We'll also have a silent auction, which has some really bang-up items in it. We're excited to show you all. We'll have some really lovely music in the first half as well. The group is called So Frenchman. You may be familiar with them, Tom. Mm-hmm. They play kind of a mix of Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, kind of that hot club jazz music. They're really fun. And then in the second half of the evening, what we're calling the Shindig, which is $15 a ticket, we will have the great band from Lexington, The Swells. We'll still have some of those great silent era short films. We'll have the silent auction going. You know, our bar will be open. We'll have all kinds of fun stuff happening.
Hayward, you might want to take this one. I understand that your plans also call for the return of live music, and you have somebody very special lined up for that. Tell us about that.
That's right. It has been quite a while since there's been live music at the theater, and ever since we opened, we've been promising live music, and finally we have it, and we're pleased to announce that it's Jeff Tweedy of Wilco doing a solo show on October the 19th. Tickets are going fast, as you might imagine. There was a lot of excitement about this.
Do you expect this to become a regular thing again?
Yeah, we are working closely with Landline Presents, which is a booker that does a lot of work with Zanzibar and the Borough here in Lexington. And we've been talking to them for a pretty long time. It's just, as you can imagine, it takes a long time to work out all of the details.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you also have a slate of scary, scary movies lined up, and some of them are even free. Is that right?
We discovered that we share a 100th birthday with probably the first horror film of them all, Nosferatu, the great vampire movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silent film from 1922, but what's particularly special is if folks know the theater, they know we have an organ here, and they know we have a lot of a great slate of people that love to play the organ. So we're going to show this live organ accompaniment. So we think it is going to be a great, scary, fun evening for folks. And then I think Lisa can tell you about all the other scary movies we have lined up.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, we have a whole bunch of them. They're on our website. So people should definitely, if they're wondering after they hear this interview, go to our website and look. We've got a 100th anniversary tab at the top. You can scroll down through there. There are a whole bunch of films. We start off, like Hayward said, with Nosferatu. We'll have House of 1,000 Zombies, Hocus Pocus, Great Family One, Frankenstein, Only Lovers Left Alive, The Mask of the Red Death, Cure, also Coraline for Neil Gaiman fans, Dracula. A lot of scary going on in 1 month. Yeah.
Your business model is now based on a membership program, which we're familiar with, of course, as a public mm-hmm. radio station. And perhaps one of you could tell us what that means if you want to become a member of the Kentucky Theater.
When we reopened, we're now a nonprofit theater, and so that means we can offer memberships. And it's pretty simple. You pay an annual membership fee, and you get a number of great perks, and you help support the theater. With a lot of levels of membership, and even at our most basic level, you're going to get a discount on virtually every film at the theater, and you're going to get discounts on concessions at the theater, and an invitation 3 times a year to a member-only event. And as you go up into the more expensive tiers, you get those basic benefits plus other things. So if you are someone that comes here almost every week, like we did before we worked here, that higher level membership is a great deal because you're paying X amount of money, but you're getting a much greater value because every movie is free to you. So we encourage people to look into it. It's a great way to support the theater if you love the theater, and it's a great way to earn some really nice perks for film lovers out there.
A discount on that super-duper popcorn you have there is...
That's right.
That sounds great. That's Lisa Meek, chair of Friends of the Kentucky Theater, and Hayward Wilkerson, director of the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Sometimes these institutions are as much about the people who keep them running as they are about the building or what's inside. Some of those people are institutions in their own right. And when we're talking about the Kentucky Theater, we have to include its manager, Fred Mills. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
How long has it been, Fred? When did you become manager of the Kentucky?
Well, actually, in management since 1970, but affiliated with the Kentucky Theater since about the summer of 1964. It's been about 53 years, not including the almost 5 years that the theater was closed back in 1987 up to 92, not including those years, I still have my tenure of about 53 years here.
Holy cow, a half century.
Yeah.
What do you know about the actual opening of the Kentucky 100 years ago?
Well, the building of the theater actually started in 1921. Harry Swido, one of the sons of the Swido family, actually stayed next door, which is the city building now, but it was the Lafayette Hotel then. And he was the person that supervised the construction of the theater. And, of course, fast forward 100 years, the Kentucky Theater was the last theater that was built in downtown Lexington. I know we have Lex Live now that's down across from the Hyatt, but I really consider that an entertainment complex, really, you know, that has a lot of bowling and arcade and so forth. But actually a true movie theater. This was the last theater that was built and the only surviving theater now that exists.
There have been a lot of major changes in the film business in recent years. What would you say have been the most important changes in the way films are distributed and that kind of thing?
Well, certainly that in 2017, you know, we converted over to digital, which we call DCPs. Prior to that, you know, that we were handling those large, heavy canisters of films. Mm-hmm. That definitely has changed the industry, you know, that maybe a 2-pound box hard drive comes and it's downloaded into the projector, and then we have to obtain keys or codes to unlock that content to be able to show it. But that's one of the main things that's happened in the last few years to the industry. Of course, streaming, I don't think that has really helped theaters any.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things that movie theaters have to contend with nowadays.
Fred, what is the strangest thing that you can recall has happened in your half century at the Kentucky Theater?
The fire that occurred next door in a restaurant in 1987. The theater was forced to close due to smoke damage, and we almost lost the theater to a wrecking ball. Thankfully, Scotty Basler, that was the mayor of Lexington, had the vision to realize how important that the theater was to downtown Lexington. And he always said that he'd gotten more telephone calls and visits and letters than any other thing that while he was in office. Looking back upon that, and it really didn't hit me till several years later that, you know, if that fire had not have happened, probably this theater might not have gotten renovated, and we may not have the theater the way it is today if that horrible occurrence had not happened.
Isn't that something? And I was going to ask you about your fondest memory from your years of managing the Kentucky, but maybe that's it.
Well, I know there's several big events that I could tell you that I can remember that happened here. 1979 was the Steel premiere downtown Lexington. That was a tragedy, you know, that when with the gentleman that went through the canopy on Vine Street there, and that was a and we premiered that film in 1979. We also got to do a national premiere of Secretariat in 2010. Had a great honor in 1996. The Kentucky Theater was chosen as the theater in Kentucky to do a series of films from the Library of Congress. And that was a great honor. They were choosing one theater from every state. And I think the Kentucky Theater in this tour that they were doing, I believe the Kentucky Theater was probably the third theater on that tour. Oh, another event I can remember when the UK Basketball Championship of 2012, the theater was absolutely packed with people. And when they won that championship, and they were, of course, the folks in attendance were the first people out on the street to Main Street to celebrate.
Oh, yeah, that had to be fun. One thing I got to ask you before we go, Fred, because this is a personal favorite. What is the secret to that popcorn that you make?
Oh, I'm not afraid. I can't tell you.
I didn't think you would.
But we hear it every day. This is the best popcorn in town. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to agree. That's Fred Mills. He's manager of the Historic Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington, kind of historic himself. And they're getting ready to celebrate the theater's 100th anniversary starting on October 8th. Good luck with that, and thanks so much, Fred Mills.
Thank you.
What lives longer than anything else on Earth gives us oxygen, stores carbons, stores and filters more than half of the water on the planet, provides shade, shelter, and food, lifts our spirits, and tends to be taken for granted, but can be sorely missed when gone? Trees. In a half dozen cities and towns in the WEKU listening area, set aside a full week every year to honor and celebrate them. The 5th annual Lexington Tree Week is coming up. It starts on Saturday, October the 8th. And here with details is Claire Hilbrecht, a member of the Tree Week planning team and a master's student in geography at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Claire.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Lexington and now Versailles, Berea, Georgetown, Hazard, and Somerset all will be celebrating Tree Week this year. Do each of these towns have special events happening during the week?
They sure do. Yeah, we're collaborating with them in some respects, so we encourage folks from Lexington to hop over to Berea or Georgetown and see what's going on in those Tree Weeks, but the folks in those communities are putting together their own events with members of the community.
Lexington has always been a place that treasures its tree canopy, but why is that important now more than ever?
Well, now we're experiencing the onset of climate change, and trees are really important resources for mitigating the effects of climate change and helping our cities be resilient to those changes. So I think now more than ever, trees are really important in helping make our cities livable and enjoyable for years to come.
We've posted a link on our website, esweku.org, and there are tons of events planned for the week. But if you could, give us a few highlights planned for Tree Week 22.
Yeah, we have tons of events from yoga in the park to tree giveaways to mulching events. So really, I think a lot of our Tree Week activities in Lexington are highlighted on tree education activities, getting folks interested and able to care for their trees. Something that I'm really looking forward to is a pick a weed, get a tree event with Seedleaf Community Garden on the Friday of the second Friday of Tree Week. There you'll spend 30 minutes doing some community service in the Seedleaf Gardens, and then you'll get a fruit tree as a giveaway. I'm also excited for an event that I'm helping put on the Wednesday of Tree Week. It's a climate conversations event where folks are encouraged to share what their passions are in fighting the climate crisis. And then our signature tree event will be really huge this year and in honor of retiring council member Susan Lamb. And that will be the first Friday of Tree Week. And we'll plant some trees in Kirk Levington Park, enjoy each other's company, and there will be a band and some tabling there as well.
All right, so lots going on. And before we go, I want to ask you, Claire, growing up or now, was there or is there a favorite tree in your life?
Yeah, I had a big tree in my front yard growing up that had two big giant branches that I thought were dragons. So this was a big silver maple, and I used to climb it and hang out in that tree. So tree climbing and hanging out in the tree canopy has always been a joy of mine. So I like to find those easily climbable trees around town.
All right, that's Claire Hilbrecht, a member of the Tree Week planning team and a master's student in geography at UK. Thanks so much for coming in, Claire.
Thank you.
One mid-October weekend starts early at Berea College. From Thursday the 13th through Sunday the 16th, the campus will be alive with traditional music made with all kinds of instruments, from banjo and fiddle to Cajun accordion and the bones. And here to fill us in on the 49th annual Berea College Celebration of Traditional Music is the festival's director, Associate Professor of Music, Liza Di Savino, who also serves as director of the Berea College Folk Roots Ensemble. Welcome, Liza.
Thank you, Tom.
Liza, our listeners can check out a full rundown of all of the artists performing at the event online, and we posted a link to that on our homepage at esweku.org. Or you can Google the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center, scroll down a bit, and click on Celebration of Traditional Music. But to give everyone a sense of what's in store, let's talk about what's happening on the night of Thursday the 13th. Who is Jaron Paxton?
Well, you've heard the term one-man band. Well, Jaron Paxton is, I think of him as a one-man everything, because he plays everything. He plays every kind of traditional music you can think of, and he's really a modern-day songster. And songsters are, black songsters are a tradition in the United States that goes back to the early 20th century. He's a performer, he's a brilliant musician, and he's funny as all get out. He just has a lightning speed sense of humor.
So he's going to be performing on that first evening. Will there be opportunities throughout the weekend to join in jam sessions?
Oh, there certainly will. There's going to be a really great jam session on Friday night at 9:15 at the Boone Tavern in the lobby. And all of the performers will be there at the jam session, as well as anybody who wants to be a participant. There's another jam, formal jam, 4 to 5 o'clock on Saturday. And we're going to have a jam tent set up. So if people want to, you know, go to a workshop and then sit and play, they can do that.
I know you've added something this year. Tell us about the Kids Zone.
Yeah, I have long wanted to get children involved in the celebration of traditional music, because it's absolutely vital to honor the past. But if we want it to be passed on, we have to be able to create environments where that can happen. So we're having a Kid Zone on Saturday, and it's going to start at 10 with a puppet show. At 11, there's a dulcimer band for kids under 12. At 2 o'clock, there's a youth band, so that'll be like a square dance band for ages 12 to 18, and they'll get to work with the Possum Queens and then sit in with the Possum Queens at a youth dance at 3:15, and anybody can come and dance at that youth dance.
That's Liza DiSavino, Associate Professor of Music at Berea College and Director of the 49th Annual Berea College Celebration of Traditional Music, happening on October 13th through the 16th, and it's all free. Thanks, Liza.
You bet.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks again to Madeline Baru for lending us her song, American. You can find the full-length song on Spotify, Apple Music, or wherever you stream. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the coming edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.